that could trigger a rally. But I guess my best prediction, and that's all it is, or anticipation, is that for the next few months, it's going to be rough. It's going to be bargains galore. And I've always believed that where you make really good money is in markets like this. But you just, the trouble is you lose at first. And this is what I think really hurts people in their ability to make money in the long run, is that they just can't take that near-term pain to get the long-term gain.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. Thanks for joining us for part two of our interview with capital manager David Hay. If you haven't yet watched part one of our discussion with David, in which he predicts lower financial asset prices are ahead for 2022 as the economy falls further into recession, head over to our channel over at youtube.com/Wealthion and watch it there first. It sets the context for the investment themes we discuss in this video. David also shares his outlook on which assets he thinks will perform best through the stagflation he sees ahead, so be sure to stick around for that. Okay, let's get started watching part two of our interview with David Hay. You know, one of the things that that obviously stock market corrections, you know, it's part of a natural boom bust cycle, right? The market cycle, which, correct me if you disagree with this, but I think many people think the Fed has been trying to put an end to that, right? It's sort of tried to replace the market cycle with a credit cycle. You know, there's a reason why cycles exist. They exist in nature, right? They're healthy. You get, when you have boom times, you get malinvestment, you get projects that shouldn't be pursued, and all that stuff gets cleared out in the bust, and then your stronger companies lead the next recovery, right? So, you know, the opportunity that lies in a recession is the ability to get great companies at great values, right? And I would assume you would say, from what you said, go slow and don't rush, you know, like, hey, we're early in the game here. You shouldn't be, this isn't the time to push all your chips into the table, but you should start watching. You should come up with your shopping list, maybe start dollar cost averaging into ones that already seem pretty cheap, but really have your dry capital, your dry powder built up, so that when we get further enough into this, where a lot of the correction has already played out, these companies are bottoming, and you know, we can start talking about the next upcycle, you've got that to deploy while these companies are still cheap, and you can really ride the most of that upcycle. I see you nodding as I'm saying all this.
Absolutely makes sense. It sounds good in theory, but it's so hard for people to do it. Because by definition, what you're describing is, okay, if I buy, let's say, Laredo Petroleum today at 64, it could easily be 50, you know, very soon. And will that same investor step up and buy it at 50 after they're down $14 a share? Most people don't. They just kind of freeze. And that's really unfortunate. I realize with individual companies, you got to be careful. You can dollar cost average into something that really, you know, crashes and finds that durable support at zero that I mentioned earlier. I mean, it certainly happened to a lot of financial stocks back in 08, 09. It almost destroyed a very famous money manager at that point, who was, you might remember The Big Short. They didn't name him by name. I won't name him by name either, but we know who it was. Anyway, that's the problem with individual securities. But you can do, you know, balance sheet analysis. It's hard for a company that's, you know, generating, you know, enormous amounts of free cash flow, excess cash flow, to go broke, right? It just doesn't happen. But obviously, the easiest way to dollar cost average is with something like an ETF, where you could say, oh, look at the XLE, which is the energy ETF. I mean, it's down 20% from where it was even back in 2014. It's really gone nowhere for 16 or 17 years. These guys are paying big dividends. They're buying back shares like crazy. They're repaying debt. I think I can afford a dollar cost average into that one. Same thing, there's an MLP ETF as well, or midstream energy ETF. So that's the safest way to dollar cost average for sure. But where you're going to make the really big money is by recognizing something, which I believe Laredo Petroleum is an example of. And also I mentioned Apache earlier. I mean, Apache's yielding, its free cash flow yield is got to be at 28% at today's price, very close to that. I mean, that just shouldn't happen. I mean, they could buy all their shares back in less than 4 years.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. That is. All right. Well, look, okay. So I want to get to, again, that question about how you're specifically looking at allocating capital. One last question beforehand is, you talked about the next up cycle where you see potentially inflation heading back higher too. The big discussion on this channel amongst most of the experts that I interview is the Fed going to pivot and when, Right. And there is a pretty wide disparity of opinion on when the Fed would pivot, because some think, look, this economy can't withstand a Fed's fund rate, you know, at 2%. And the Fed's going to hike until something starts breaking. They just have different opinions on when things are going to start breaking. And so folks like Luke Groman think the Fed is going to pivot in Q3. He says by the end of Q3, but I'll take the under on that bet, right? There are others who are saying, I think the Fed's more committed here than most folks realize. And, you know, they're going to go higher. I heard you mention maybe 4% or so. But I guess my question is, what's your answer to those questions about the pivot timing? But also, when you talk about the next up cycle, is that dependent on the Fed reversing policy here?
Yes. Answer that one first. I think it is. But I think you raised an important point. I think there's a distinction between how much the economy can handle higher interest rates and financial markets. I think the economy is actually, I realize it's losing a lot of momentum right now. And I forgot to mention this earlier. I think one of the big reasons for that is just how much wealth destruction that's happened. Mm-hmm. And you probably have seen these same images that I have, that this has been the greatest wealth destruction in the post-World War II period. It succeeded COVID. It succeeded the global financial crisis. So people have lost trillions of dollars. And when they lose trillions of dollars, they kind of hunker down.
Right. You get the negative wealth effect.
So that in that way, that's where I think that's not so much the interest rate rise. But you can say, well, it's collateral damage of the interest rate rise that's created this drag on the real economy. But I don't think, 3% interest rates are really a big deal. I say 6% mortgage rates. Well, that is, that's certainly going to hurt housing.
Right. I was going to say, we haven't talked about housing, but when you talk about negative wealth effect on the consumer, that's probably the number one injury is if housing prices go down, then a lot of people feel a lot less wealthy.
And I think that's going to happen. I think you're going to see housing come down 15, 20%. I think prices just got simply too high. But since we brought up that, go down that side road a little bit. Unlike 2007, when I was so bearish on housing, you haven't had the overbuilding, at least with single family. I think where the overbuilding has been recently, the last couple of years, is multifamily. I think that's going to be the trouble spot, particularly in some of the cities that are losing people. And I also think that's true of commercial real estate as well. It's been pretty amazing. You know, when you think about Amazon and the comments they make, everybody thought distribution warehouses were invulnerable. And all of a sudden it looks like there's maybe a glut of those. And so, yeah, a lot of things going wrong, but I do think that the Fed, that they do have a big ace up their sleeve, and that's this $1 trillion worth of treasuries that they've got maturing. And I think what they could do is pivot more the way I mentioned, which is intervening in the credit markets if they get bad enough. And to be clear, I don't think 600 over on the junk bonds, which again means about a 9% yield, is there. But you start getting up to 11, 12%, I think the Fed will say, look, we're going to keep hiking, or maybe we're going to pause if it's 3 or 4 months from now, but we're going to do this for the credit markets. That will be an unexpected pivot, I would argue. And of course, it's the unexpected that could have the really big ramifications for the market. So that could trigger a rally. But I guess my best prediction, and that's all it is, or anticipation, is that for the next few months, it's going to be rough. It's going to be bargains galore. And I've always believed that where you make really good money is in markets like this. But the trouble is you lose at first. And this is what I think really hurts people in their ability to make money in the long run, is that they just can't take that near-term pain to get the long-term gain. And I don't see it glibly, it's not easy, but I think if you go into the buying program with the mindset, I'm expecting that I'm going to need to buy more at lower prices. I'm fully prepared for that. I'm looking forward to that. That's what Buffett does. He's the master at that. That's why he's made so much money. But most of us humans, we're not wired that way. We want instant gratification, right?
Right. And it's so funny. And we talk a lot in this program how it's our emotions that are actually by far usually our worst opponent on the battlefield when it comes to investing, because they generally force us to make the wrong decision at the wrong time. And look, nobody wants to ride a stock to zero, like you're saying. But if you're a long-term investor, you should actually like the ability to buy more at better values. But Americans just hate that. We love to chase a stock that's going up, right?
Absolutely. Well, I think that's why you were asking me, where do we like, and I'll hit hammer again. I like the bond market in here, the corporate bond market with it. It can go lower too, for sure. But when you buy a bond that's going to come due in a few years at a 7% yield, I mean, you can kind of put up with some price loss. And I do find that's what we did in the financial crisis, when people were just too terrified to buy common stocks, but they would buy bonds and they would buy preferreds. And so that's, at least that's doing something. It's maybe not optimal, but it's better than just sitting in cash.
Oh, absolutely. All right. Well, look, let's get to the main event. So you manage a multi-billion dollar portfolio. You've given us some good assets to consider already, but just to maybe directly ask you kind of in terms of your shopping list here, or what you like or what you're watching most closely, if you can just sort of go through that for folks here, both what you like and what you'd stay away from. And just to help remind folks here, you talked about commodities in general. Certainly you like lots of elements about energy, and you've talked about that a fair amount. And you just explained why you like corporate bonds here. What else would you add to the list?
Well, I think another thing is high quality companies that are priced for recession. Goldman Sachs did a study of those recently, where they said, let's go back and look at the collection of companies that are basically trading at recession valuations already. And I've been kind of doing that with this because I have a tracked equity portfolio and a tracked income portfolio that we put in our weekly Making Hay Monday. And it's going to go out today on Tuesday because of the holiday. But that's something for people to be aware of. It's free. And it gives specific investment advice. And I mean, a couple of examples here recently that have hung in pretty well were FedEx and Qualcomm, that were both way down at, you know, really at recession levels. And FedEx has actually had a bounce, and Qualcomm has gone down a little bit. But I think that's a pretty good way to look at it. But again, I would, with anything these days, I would buy a sum here and then wait.
Okay. And are these companies that, A, that have sort of pre-crashed, right? But also ones like, what are some of the things you look at? Is it cash flow? Like when you really, what attracts you the most about companies like these?
Well, some of it's qualitative. And, you know, you look at a FedEx, I mean, it's a world-class franchise. Qualcomm, you know, kind of the same thing in the tech area. They're both trading kind of in the 10 times earnings range, which is, you know, now you can say, well, maybe earnings are going to come down, but when you're at that kind of a multiple, and that's kind of what the Goldman Sachs test did, was they said, okay, let's assume earnings come down 20%. And these things are still inexpensive. And so that's, but that helps a bit, but it's not a panacea. I mean, if you get into a really, really bad market, it's just, and I've been in really, really bad markets. So I, unlike a lot of people in the business these days that don't know what it's like to be in a protracted bear market. I mean, the last one we had was 2000 to 2002. But I'm again old enough to remember the 1970s, where stocks just for a decade, I would have a
just few languished.
Years. Yeah, it was what, I mean, lost big money relative to inflation. And I think we're in kind of a repeat of that particular cycle. I really think you're going to have to trade a lot more in this environment than just a typical buy and hold. I think there's going to be some huge rally. That's one thing we've also been recommending, is, you know, sell into these rallies, raise cash into the rallies, and which we had one, you know, a couple of weeks ago that we were lucky enough to call. And frankly, it was not because of me. It was because of my friend, Vincent Delaward, who's done this great study. Tell me if you've heard about this, but he looks at target date funds. As far as I know, he's the only guy that really looks at target date funds, because they're $3 trillion now. So they have a huge footprint and they have to rebalance. So at the end of a bad quarter for stocks, they sell bonds and buy stocks. And it typically happens kind of around between the 15th and the 30th of the end of a quarter. And that's exactly what happened here a couple of weeks ago. And we got a 6.5% rally, you know, just out of the blue. And it's not just target dates. There's other portfolios that rebalance, but they're the whales these days.
Yeah.
So, but the big point, whatever the catalyst is, I think you need to be willing to take some short-term profits, as opposed to, I'm just going to buy and hold for the long run. Well, that worked great for 40 years, but I think we're into much more of a trading range environment like we were in the 1970s.
All right, great. And so I just want to underscore that, because David, as you likely know on these programs, and after we finish interviewing you, we're going to bring on the financial advisors that I have on this program every week to sort of talk about what the markets have done. But they, like you, often say that, echo right now, that we are sort of re-entering, you know, the past 10 years, you could almost say the past 20 years, the dartboard did pretty well, right? Because all boats were rising. And, you know, largely you had the Fed put, and you had all this liquidity giving wind at the market's back, record low interest rates, you know, certainly helped juice all that. Now we're in a completely different era, and we're going to go back to what investing used to be, right? Where you really have to do your gumshoe homework. You can't just pick a sector. And because of this sort of whiplash, you know, Fed policy of lurching from one area to another, there's going to be a lot more volatility here. And so you just can't kind of buy and hold and cross your fingers and just expect everything to go up year after year. You're going to have to be a lot more intentional and a lot more nimble. I see you nodding as I'm saying this.
I think that's precisely right. Yeah. Couldn't agree more. And that's not how most people are wired.
Well, I mean, it's not. And I talk about this a lot about in terms of like musculature, which is for most adult investors right now, they've had that tailwind at their back. And so, you know, the buy and hold and the buy the dip strategy has worked great. And so that's the muscles that folks have developed. So they literally, the muscles for the era we're entering into are very atrophied, you know, in most people. And it's going to have to be like an entire new regimen to get into shape to actually succeed at that right now.
For sure. I mean, I think we've gone from the buy the dips to sell the reps, just to use a silly little soundbite. Okay.
It's a nice, easy to remember mnemonic. Yeah. All right. So look, as we wrap up here, one thing that we didn't talk about, David, much was the dollar. So I'm curious just to hear any thoughts you have on the dollar and its influence going forward, if you think it's going to remain strong, if you think it's going to weaken. And in your answer, if you could also maybe just really briefly touch on gold and the role of gold, because you do think that inflation is going to be higher going forward. Conventionally, you'd hold gold as an inflation hedge. Gold has done okay. It's one of the few assets that isn't down an awful lot this year, but it hasn't ripped the way that people thought it would, given, you know, 9% CPI. So anyways, dollar and gold, what do you think?
Well, since you brought that up, that has been my worst prediction of the last year or so, because I really did think the dollar was going to be under downward pressure for a whole bunch of reasons. And instead it's gone up. And I've been really right about interest rates, really right about energy, at least till lately. But that one I got wrong, though I did concede that it could move up near term, but that the long-term outlook is very negative for it. And a lot of that relates to just, you know, we're talking about these entitlements that they're out there. I mean, that should be very bearish for a currency to have that kind of an entitlement overhang. And then you look at the huge amount of deficit, trade deficit. So we're a twin deficit country to a huge degree. And again, those maybe the trade deficit will get a little bit better because of a recession, but the budget deficit's going to get a whole lot worse. So I think actually I'm going to write a piece on this coming up about the dollar being the next big short. I think it will come down. A lot of that's going to depend on the Fed and if they do some kind of a pivot, because that's what it's, again, these markets get kind of a, almost like the Fed, they get onto a certain narrative and they won't let go. It's just like a mono narrative. And the mono narrative is the Fed's tightening, therefore buy the dollar. It ignores the fact that other central banks in some cases are tightening even more. And it ignores the fact that real interest rates are still deeply negative in the US. And you've got to, I know if you say, well, you look at the inflation expectations and therefore now you've got slightly positive real interest rates, but you know, that might be a bit of a stretch. Again, I think if we get down to 3 or 4% on inflation, we'll be lucky. So I'm bearish on the dollar long-term, and it's another one of those where you probably, you know, if gold and the dollar, of course, are almost like opposite sides of the same coin. And so that's been a reason that gold has struggled as much as it has in US dollars. If you look at gold in other currencies, it's been doing great. You know, look at gold in the yen, it looks like a powerhouse, but that's not how the world looks at it. They look at it in terms of dollars. And of course the gold miners have been absolutely crushed lately. They're not acting well. They've broken some near-term support. I still really like them long-term because I do think we're entering into a world where there's going to be some kind of a currency reset. And the dollar will, you know, I'm sure it'll be one of the reserve currencies, but I actually think that we're setting up for a time where the ultimate reserve currency is going to be energy. And I think that's certainly the way Putin is pivoting. So it's, I don't think it's going to be a good decade for the dollar, to be honest with you. And I think things like the Swiss franc make more sense, and even, you know, Canadian currency, Canadian government bonds, which are actually yield a little bit more than the US, Australian, although both of those countries have, make our housing bubble look, you know, tiny. Like
yeah, I know. All right. So just to recap then, it seems like you don't forecast a good rest of the decade for the dollar. It sounds like you expect it to weaken versus other currencies, or at least select other currencies, because you know the problem here is you have the whole clean a shirt in the hamper or the best horse in the glue factory or whatever, right? I mean, a lot of these currencies are not doing great themselves either. But it sounds like you think that the DXY will come down a certain amount. If I'm reading between the lines, it sounds like you think that the dollar is going to weaken dramatically against hard commodities. Correct. Like gold, like oil, et cetera. Correct? Correct.
I think we had a little bit of a sneak preview of that in the last year and a half until, again, June 8th. That's when everything seemed to the flip. But yeah, I think there's going to be more of that to come for all the reasons that we talked about. I mean, if we really are going to do this massive electric vehicle shift, and it really is massive. I mean, it's unbelievably ambitious. I think it's too ambitious, frankly. I don't think we can do it. And you know, we're going to be really reliant on rare earth minerals from China. It's in some ways, it's another just crazy policy decision, but I know that's the way things are trending. But you know, copper, aluminum, I mean, those things are just going to go nuts at some point. So I think that's where you have to kind of look through the recession fears and think about the longer term outlook of demand for these commodities. And, you know, some are more attractive than others. You know, you'd probably say palladium is more attractive than platinum, for example, and copper is maybe more attractive than silver, but I think silver is going to go up too. I just, you know, you buy a diversified portfolio, at least part of your portfolio of these things, I think they're going to save you, frankly. Again, just think of how few people have weightings to them. They are so underweight in most portfolios by definition, because they're so underweight in the indexes and most people basically just index.
Right, right. Well, we talk about the precious metals a fair amount in this program. So a lot of people are aware of the fact that how underowned they are, right? So to your point, I mean, if you just had a percent or two of kind of the global capital want to go into those markets, some of them, it would just completely send to the moon. I mean, silver is a tiny, tiny market, right? Exactly. So, all right. And then of course there's the whole, you know, some of those commodities you mentioned are ones that are going to be supply constrained because of the starvation of CapEx, you know, in the industry. Mining's a good example of that. So in wrapping up here, it sounds like what you're saying is in the near term, let's say the next, I'm going to say maybe 1 to 2 years as we head into this recession, demand destruction is what's going to be driving the bus. But coming out of that, as we go into the next up cycle, supply constraints might really become the limiting factor, the key issue. You're nodding as I'm saying
yes.
This.
Yes, I agree. And I also kind of agree with Luke Grimm. I don't know about third quarter, but I think he's pretty much in the right ballpark there that the Fed's going to be doing something supportive sooner rather than later. You know, maybe it's the fourth quarter. I don't think they'll stay as tough as they are right now through the full year. And just, you know, taking their foot off the brake a little bit could be quite beneficial to asset prices. But my fear is it's going to be beneficial from a lot lower price than where we are right now for a number of securities. And that, they won't all bottom at the same time. You've been around like I have a long time. You know that certain sectors will bottom first. And one of the, you know, it's always hard to say when a trough is hit. But if you look back to the spring of 2020 with energy, there was some really bad news, you know, like you talked about, the futures price. Again, it was the futures price. It wasn't the physical price of oil. It went negative. And yet the energy stocks quit going down kind of around that time. So I think that's what we should be on alert for, is when we see continuing bad news and then asset prices quit going down. That'll be probably a pretty good heads up. We're close to the pivot point.
We're close to the bottom. Great. Okay. So again, just to recap then, it sounds like you think, and this is all just we're projecting here. Nobody has a crystal ball. Absolutely. But it sounds like you think that that financial asset prices are going to continue their fall through the quarter, more or less, up until the point at which the Fed reverses policy or has some change in policy. And then will you be poised to deploy a lot of your capital then? Will that be kind of the green light to say, okay, a new upcycle to ride, let's get chips on the table?
I sure hope so. And I guess a template for that was in COVID. I mean, that was a similar period, except it happened so quickly where prices just were, you know, cratering. But once the Fed announced that they were going to buy corporate bonds, it was like, okay, guys, that's our green light. I mean, we really bought aggressively at that point. And I think we're going to get another one of those moments. I hope so.
Okay, great. Well, we'd love to have you back on the program by then or before then, David, to give us an audible update under your forecast. For folks that have really enjoyed getting to know you through this interview, maybe hadn't been aware of you before, where can they go to learn more about you and to follow your work? And I think you mentioned several times that you put out a regular publication that's free.
We do. The best way would be for them to go to Haymaker at Substack. So we publish through Substack. All of our work, including Bubble 3.0, was originally published. The book was published through Substack early this year because we wanted to be ahead of the complete bursting of the bubble. So Haymaker at substack.com. And then I think you've got some information. If the audiobook, just coincidentally, is just out this week. So for people that like to listen to it rather than read it, that's another way to go. It's We've got a special discount for your listeners. So I think it's like $14.60 per download. And then we'll have the hard copy out here very soon.
Fantastic. All right. So folks, we'll have a link to that book offer that David mentioned down in the description of this video below. Also, if you'd like to see the latest copy of David's Haymaker Report, just go to wealthion.com/hay and you can find it there. David, it's been a wonderful, really fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for coming on the program. Like I said, we'd love to have you back on again soon. Really appreciate you giving us so much time.
Of course. You give me the invite, I'll be here. Do a great job. I've listened to a number of your podcasts and everyone has been first rate. So thank you for inviting me.
Well, you're very kind. It's really all of the quality of the guests, and thank you for helping us up that quality.
All right, Adam. Talk to you soon.
All right. Well, now's the time on the program where we bring in the lead partners from New Harbor Financial, one of the financial advisory firms endorsed by Wealthion, to talk a little bit about what David just said. Also talk about what the markets are doing right now. I'm joined as usual by John Lodra and Mike Preston. Hey guys, Mike, why don't we start with you? Well, let's start first with your reaction to what David had to say about the quote, total mess that he thinks today's global economy and financial markets find themselves in.
Yeah, that was just a fact-packed talk. I really enjoyed it. I'm looking through my notes. There's just so much here, not even sure what to start with. But, you know, like you normally ask, yes, Adam, what is their outlook on the global financial markets? And David said it's a total mess. We agree. And, you know, he points out that the Fed is to blame. The Fed has created three massive bubbles in, 25 years. We've had two big busts. We think we're at the forefront of the third and largest bust. I mean, the market is holding on stubbornly. It's been a very orderly decline so far since the January 4th peak in the S&P. But we think we're about ready to see a waterfall decline of some sort. We haven't really had any panic yet. It's like I said, it's been very orderly. And most people that we talk to here are a little bit concerned, but not too much. You know, at the same time, we see various things happening, like, for instance, resource stocks are getting really hurt here as the U.S. dollar is getting really strong. Those we agree that those particular pockets may offer some opportunities. David says he continues to believe that the next few months are going to offer some opportunities, and he advises raising cash, lowering equity exposure, and getting ready for some opportunities. And he talks again about resource stocks, about being particular opportunities. He mentioned some other things too, which frankly, we're not too tuned into at the moment. Like for instance, some certain high yield bonds. I think that he has some specialty in those areas that I don't think we can profess to have, but still the punchline of the story is that there's going to be opportunities in the next quarter or so. We completely agree. There's a lot of talk about lack of honesty at the Fed and how the narrative keeps changing to suit whatever they're trying to do. I think that's really the story of not only the last 12 or 14 years, but the last 30 years. There's no real game plan. There's no plan B. It's all the same thing. Press the easy button, print some more money, and we can keep doing that because of our massive trade deficit. We can continue to flood the world with dollars, but seems to me that we're coming up on a point here where that's going to become harder and harder to do, particularly as inflation is persistent. And David says that inflation will maybe ease some, but probably stay up around the 5% rate year on year. And in the face of a recession, which we probably or may already be in, it's going to be difficult to do all that without some severe downside pressure in equities, particularly at the hyper overvaluation point that we still find ourselves in. So a lot there to chew on, and I guess I'll pause after that.
All right. Well, you mentioned a number of great points. A few I want to pivot now to you, John, David, like many of our guests, thinks that we are headed into a recession, initially a stagflationary one, then maybe inflation cooling a bit and it becoming more just like a, regular standard recession. But heading into recession here, he thinks that financial asset prices are going to continue to go down. This bear market's going to continue. until the Fed pivots. And then, of course, the big question is, you know, when is the Fed going to pivot or whatnot? He sort of seemed to think later this year, maybe not quite in Q3, the way that guys like Luke Gromen think. But I got the impression that he didn't think this was going to bleed too much. The Fed was going to wait too much into next year. It'd probably be later this year, or maybe at the latest early next year. So looking at this environment where we've got the economy slowing, falling into recession, potentially asset prices continuing to come down along the way, you know, it's a challenging environment to, you know, manage capital into. So as you guys look at that type of potential scenario, what does that mean to you in terms of, you know, how you're going to be prioritizing your decisions here around capital management?
Yeah, thank you, Adam. I as well thought that was a information-packed talk that David gave. Look, I think one of the things that he characterized what he thinks the next several weeks and months will look like is very in line with what we expect. One that is likely to be range bound, but with a trend lower and possibly quite significantly lower. He characterized a market that probably invites folks to, if they're clear thinking, to sell the rallies and buy the dips. And you know, the thing we would caution about in this environment is being too eager to buy the dips, because we do see a lot of kind of fracturing. There has been a pretty dramatic market reaction in recent days to what might be interpreted as an a deflationary, recessionary kind of signal. Look at bond yields, for example. The 10-year Treasury bond yield had spiked up very quickly from like 2.8% up to almost 3.5%, and kind of fell back down almost as quickly to roughly about 2.8. That is a pretty big move in the bond yields, and that kind of speaks to a market kind of believing perhaps that recession is that much more likely and slowdown to come with that.
And sorry to interrupt you there, John, but is that because that's capital moving to safety, moving into the safety of treasuries here, you think?
I think it is. That certainly is, would be consistent with a capital flow from risk assets into safer things. And even just looking within the bond space, if you look, for example, what's happened in recent days and weeks, again, treasuries have rallied a little bit because yields have come off. That hasn't happened in the high yield junk bond, corporate bond market, for example. That shows a divergence in the bond market that, is speaking pretty clearly to risk off rather than risk on. And, we don't want to draw too many trend lines into the indefinite future. Things are always unfolding, but that is not an encouraging sign for risk assets. And we think stocks have, certainly plenty more, fundamental reasons to reprice down lower, and David certainly is of that mind. He spoke of, we think it's probably very plausible for the Fed to have to do some kind of pivot. What exactly that looks like, whether it's pausing on rate hikes, freaking out and suddenly starting to drop rates again, or some kind of yield curve control or credit market intervention like David talked about. Who knows? But we do think it's likely going to be their hands are probably tied, that something, I don't know if Luke Gromen used the term, but until something breaks, maybe it was Stephanie Pomboy, one of your other great guests. But yeah, we think there is, and David kind of agrees, he thinks that there's going to have to be some pretty bad economic news before the Fed kind of abandons the tough talk on inflation, because it is a real concern. It's a political concern as much as folks want to believe and interpret the Fed as being apolitical. That it's clearly not the case if you look back in history. So we think we're in an environment where there will be probably opportunities to tactically add some exposure, but with the mindset that we're likely in a phase change here where ultimately lower prices are ahead and more durable bottoms are ahead than right now.
Okay. And you mentioned that David mentioned he banged through a couple of things where I thought, oh, this is really like-minded with the guys at New Harbor. One, he said that buy and hold is probably not going to work very well in the environment that we are heading into. It's a different era than what we've been used to over the past couple of decades. Like you guys, he recommends sort of selling into any rallies we have here, at least leading up until such time as the Fed might pivot. And then I think you mentioned this earlier, John, too, but that he's, you know, says, hey, you know, it's the time to build dry powder, right? Increase your cash reserves. He said, look, you know, there's some potential companies, and he mentioned a few energy ones that he said, you know, they've already sort of pre-crashed. So you might want to start beginning to dollar cost average in kind of a dip your toe in the water style to big quality names that are trading at attractive valuation multiples right now. But it seems like he thinks the general market trend is lower. So he's more or less saying, but keep the majority of your cash dry so that when we get down to the period where the market really does seem to have bottomed and or the Fed has pivoted, then that's going to be the time to deploy capital. And he talked about you know, looking at the market for that when bad news comes out, when the beaten down names don't drop any further, when more bad news comes out, he says that's usually a good sign that you're kind of near a tradable bottom and that it just needs a spark of good news to get turned around here. I see you nodding as I'm saying this, John. Just anything else you want to add to that?
No, I think that's, you know, that's there's certain, and this is touched upon what I think Mike pointed out in our last week's video. We're not seeing kind of the sentiment, you know, panic, fear, you know, there is more, you know, we're sensing more of a disengagement rather than fear, you know, just kind of like stepping back. Some folks are just maybe not trying to pay attention to, you know, I just saw a chart today that pointed out that a global 60-40 portfolio of stocks and bonds is back below where it was pre-pandemic, which is, you know, that's repealing quite a bit of, you know, levitation that the stimulus in the wake of COVID had you know, caused in asset prices. But a lot of people, you know, still aren't, you know, yeah, maybe the headlines say, you know, bear market and things like that. But we've sensed no palpable fear or really panic on the part of the folks that we talk to generally. It's more of, you know, okay, we're in a digesting period, but there's not this sense of panic. And then usually bottoms are bred when there is this kind of sense of some kind of panic or despair, however small or large that might be.
Right, as we've said, you know, bear markets are over when like nobody ever wants to touch a stock again. Now, you know, of course, a lot of your clients aren't panicking because you guys have actually performed very well this year on a relative basis. Last couple of times we've talked, you guys have been roughly flat with the markets. Love to hear kind of where you are right now. I'm guessing you guys might be down a little bit for the year just because your biggest position or one of your biggest positions is precious metals and precious metals miners. And as Mike was just saying, they've gotten whacked with the rest of the resource sector relatively recently. So Mike, coming to you, ballpark, what's performance doing like these days?
We're down slightly, Adam. You know, we were roughly flat, as you say, when you asked us last week or the week before. We're down a little. I don't have the latest number. It might be 1 or 2%, something like that.
Okay.
And that's
a low single digit percent. Okay, and appreciate the transparency. And of course, that's pretty good relative to down 20 on the S&P or down 30 on the NASDAQ or whatnot. But
yeah, and the real reason is, you know, we got out of a couple of our positions 2 weeks ago. We took a stop on one of them that was exposed to basic materials, and we took a small loss on that, and we adhered to our discipline. We're glad we did because it's lower now. And oil service stocks we sold that same week. It was called away because we had a short call option hedge on it. And so we sold that, and you know, ironically, that's or coincidentally, that's fallen further too since we sold it. We were certainly looking to get back into those areas: real assets, commodities, base metals, oil, energy. But you know, the dollar's been really strong, and commodities in general had a big run. So the pullback can be deeper than you might expect. So we'd like to maybe get back into that sector. I think almost certainly want to get back into those sectors. But we'll be scaling in, much like David just talked about a little while ago on the talk. So at the moment, we've got very little exposure at all. Our biggest exposure is gold mining stocks. Even there, we can defray a good part of the downside with the hedges that we use, but it's not perfect. Every hedge has some kind of deductible, and we have hit those deductibles a few times over in the last month or so in gold miners. So that's contributed to slight negative performance, as we just talked about, but we have, you know, over 50% cash equivalents. We have lots of dry powder. We're looking for that first kind of elevator drop in the market so we can add some tactical longs in the broad indexes and start to build back exposure in those sectors that look good to us. But as we sit here, we just have to be patient, because I'm looking at a chart of the S&P. It's roughly exactly where it was last week when we talked. Really not much changed. Volatility is about the same when you look at the VIX. What's changed is the dollar's stronger quite a bit than it was last week, and commodities, particularly gold, is down about $80 from where we talked a week ago. So those things are changing. But the real thing that hasn't changed is the bedrock S&P, NASDAQ. It's kind of going sideways here the last few weeks, and there's no real decisive move or panic. And we're looking for that first move down to get more active here.
Okay. Well, in terms of the move down, I talked a little bit about this with David. We are now just a week or two shy of the onset of earnings reports, the Q2 earning reports from many companies. And looking at the tea leaves, it looks like an awful lot of them are going to be bringing their forecasts down for the rest of the year and for 2023. And mathematically, you know, if they do, stock analysts have to bring down their earnings forecasts. And mathematically, that needs to bring stock prices down, because stock prices are based upon forward earnings projections. So that could be the next shoe to drop here. Is that something you guys are going to be watching closely, Mike?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, earnings estimates are probably too high. I mean, we are almost certainly in a bear market and have been so for 6 or 7 months, even though it really doesn't feel like it yet. And surprises happen to the downside in bear markets. And if the data is correct and the charts are correct and the charts are saying that we should be moving down more and soon, it's probably going to be earnings revisions that are a bit of a surprise to the market that might be the next catalyst. So it's impossible to predict. And earnings can be, for lack of a better word, manipulated sometimes. But I think by and large, the surprises are going to be the downside and probably will contribute to the next leg down. And we will be watching that closely, and we're going to try to take advantage of it if we can.
Okay. And one thing, I'll come to you, John, to react to this. John, you were talking about how you guys just don't feel like you've sort of seen yet in the story the capitulation that you sort of expect at the end of a bear market cycle. And certainly one trigger that could bring more pain is the earnings disappointments that we just talked about here. Another one could be, and I'll say looks likely to be, a correction in the housing market. And now housing takes longer to correct, obviously, than stocks. But it's a much more widely owned asset class. And you talked about how, you know, looking at the S&P, you know, it's now basically down sort of near where it was, back in 2019 or whatnot, meaning we've sort of given up the gains post pandemic. And, you know, somebody can argue that, hey, you know, maybe those weren't really real, you know, in the sense that they were juiced, they weren't going to last for very long. So, you know, things got crazy, now they're getting uncrazy. You could say the same, you know, may be happening on a delayed scale in the housing market. You know, housing was up 20% year over year here. I've heard from a lot of housing analysts, they feel like, yeah, it's true, but that's not really like, those aren't sustainable gains. And given everything that we've been talking about here, and everything that you know, I've been reporting in recent videos on the cooling that we're seeing in the housing market these days, that froth could go away really quickly too. So curious to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, absolutely. We do believe that all assets, or many, many assets, have been, you know, subject to the same kind of price levitation. Those kinds of phenomena reverse in concert too. The housing market, you know, I think there's been a pretty dramatic, even if subtle shift. Just anecdotally, I was out visiting a family member in Denver a couple weeks ago, and pretty hot housing market, as measured across the country. And this real estate agent, a friend of my family members, basically spoke of, wow, the last 2 months have been a dramatic shift in the tone of the market, but sellers really haven't come off their prices yet. So that's one of the, whether you're talking about stock, people selling stocks that have appreciated or houses, one of the last, pillars to knock out, I think, is when sellers start to become less reluctant to drop prices. And in fact, when they do, it's usually because there's this whiff of fear, and it has a snowball kind of effect because everybody starts to feel that at once, because the market has this kind of psychology to it. I think we're seeing it. We've seen even, like, for example, in recent times with recent pullbacks in interest rates, the demand for mortgages has not been as, tightly, correlated with that, as traditionally has been. So I think we're starting to see some of that cooling off of at least buying demand or frenzy. And the last shoe to drop usually is price drops on the part of sellers to kind of get out while the getting's good, if you will. I think a real asset like housing obviously has some, structural support, perhaps more than a negative earnings tech stock, but it doesn't mean they can't get, dramatically overpriced, especially in some locations.
Right, right. And looking now at almost every metric you look at, whether it's, listings rising or mortgage applications declining, and even price cuts are now dramatically on the rise, especially in a lot of markets that used to be pretty bulletproof. But to your point there, John, it doesn't look like we've seen sort of the tip over yet, or at least the selling wave begin in earnest yet. And a big reason for that, we've talked about a number of times in this program, is the importance of the marginal buyer, right? Where, so, sellers are, they're like a herd, right? And the herd doesn't immediately get spooked. What happens is it kind of compacts in more tightly as the cows get more and more scared, but they don't move, and they don't move until the first cow bolts, and then everybody takes off, right? And it's similar in a housing market where nobody wants to sell, right? Because nobody wants to bring their price down because nobody, wants to lose the nice tasty gains that they've had. But invariably in there is somebody who is either more vulnerable than the rest or a weaker hand, or they say, look, there's a first mover advantage here, right? If I get out, I can get out and just list my house for a couple percent lower than, what the last one sold for, and then I'm out, right? I don't care what happens after that, right? And once those first early sellers start selling, then it quickly becomes a waterfall because nobody wants to be the bag holder who's riding this thing all the way down. And then, you sort of see this cascade effect. And I see you nodding as I'm saying this. Yeah. All right. So just in wrapping up here, guys. So, David, like I said, foresees a stagflationary future here, at least in the short term, continued economic slowing, but CPI still staying quite elevated, maybe coming down slowly, but not super fast. And so there's still a lot of interest amongst folks about, okay, how do I protect my wealth, purchasing power of my wealth versus inflation? And even some traditional inflation hedges haven't performed great, like gold. You just mentioned that it's down, $80 an ounce from last week. So coming to you with this, Mike, but real quick, I just released a video a few minutes before I hopped on here with you guys about I-bonds and how to use them. Folks, if you're interested in that, I'll put up a link to it right here. That'd be a really good short video to go watch after this one. And I-bonds provide, very powerful protection against at least the reported CPI inflation rate. Now they've got some limitations, like you can only buy so many of them in a given year. And then of course, guys, there are other instruments out there like TIPS and whatnot. But Mike, my question is if folks want to have a conversation around, hey, what can I do in my portfolio to get some additional inflation protection? I assume that's something you guys can help them think through, in terms of how much to buy in TIPS, how much to buy in I-bonds, how much to buy in other potential types of inflation hedges, et cetera. Is that true?
Of course, we're here and we're available, and you don't have to be a client to have a conversation with us. We're happy to help, you know, and iBonds make sense for a nice, although limited, constant savings program. We'll certainly want to suggest gold and silver, particularly at these prices. We've just had a very big pullback. And happy to hop on the phone and have a conversation with anybody about this. Absolutely.
All right, guys. Well, so folks, if you're interested in doing that, stick around at the end of the video. We tell you how to schedule one of those free consultations. You don't have to work with these guys. Like Mike said, you don't have to be a client. You just do it as a public service. So stick around at the end of the video for that. And in wrapping up here, folks, if you enjoyed the interview with David, would like to see him on again and other great minds like him, please support this channel by hitting the like button and then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. And John and Mike, thanks for giving us your time on yet another week. Hope you guys had a good fourth, and whatever happens in the markets from here. But one thing we can guarantee about that is that we'll be here next week dissecting it for folks and trying to make sense of it for them. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.
Enjoyed it yet again, Adam. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, Adam, and happy summer, everybody. See you soon.
If you'd like to schedule a consultation with one of the financial advisors at New Harbor Financial, simply go to wealthion.com. These consultations are completely free, and there are no strings attached. The good folks at New Harbor will simply answer any questions you have about your investment goals or your portfolio and give you their best advice given their latest market outlook. They're willing to do this because they care about protecting people's wealth, and because Wealthion has connected them with so many thoughtful investors just like you over the past decade. We started doing this because so many people have approached us in frustration, looking for a solution because they're feeling out of alignment or downright ridiculed by the standard financial advisors who have been managing their money. You know the type. The kind that just pushes all of your money into the market, scoffs at the idea of owning gold, and when you bring up concerns about the market's sky-high valuations, they say, "Don't worry. The market will always take care of you." For many of the reasons discussed in today's video, we think this is one of the most challenging and treacherous times in history for investing. We strongly believe that today's investors are best served working in partnership with a conscientious professional financial advisor who understands the risks in play. Now, we're agnostic which professional advisor you work with, as long as they're good. If you're already working with one, that's fantastic. Stick with them. But if you don't, or are having trouble finding one you respect or trust, then consider talking to John and Mike and the team at New Harbor. Now, for those about to ask, yes, there's a business relationship between Wealthion and New Harbor, which we've put in place to make sure everything is handled according to SEC regulations. All the details on this are clearly provided on the Wealthion.com website. Also, it's important to note that New Harbor is able to work with U.S. citizens, green card holders, and those with existing assets in the USA. But for regulatory reasons, they aren't able to take on non-US clients. All right, with all that said, if you'd like some insight and guidance on how to protect your wealth during this unprecedented time in the markets, go to wealthion.com to schedule your free consultation with the good folks at New Harbor. Thanks for watching.